Professor Polak, it's such an honor to have you on this segment of regenerative medicine, the Regenerative Medicine Summit. So thank you so much for joining me.
I'm delighted to be back with you once again.
What I'd like to, just for the audience to kind of get to know you, I'm sure that the majority of them already know all the amazing work that you're doing, but I just want to kind of highlight some of the things that you are part of. So Professor Gerald Polak maintains an active laboratory at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's the founding editor-in-chief of Water, a multidisciplinary research journal, executive director of the Institute of Venture Science, co-founder of Fourth Phase Incorporated, and founder of the annual conference on the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. He has received numerous honors, including the I probably just gonna butcher this. Prigogine,
Prigogine.
Prigogine. Okay, thanks. A Prigogine Medal for Thermodynamics, the University of Washington Annual Faculty Lecturer, the NIH Director's Transformative Research Award, and the first Emoto Peace Prize. He is recognized internationally as an accomplished speaker and author, and most notably, his last book, The Fourth Face of Water. Well, I'm curious, why water? I know in our prior discussions you mentioned that water was you were actually suggested to not study water, and here you are.
Well, you have a good memory. Yeah, it was I was in a department of biomedical engineering for my PhD, and by some coincidence, completely unrelated to what we do and now, there was an emphasis on water in biology in that department. And as a student, my interest in that subject was as close to zero as could be. It held almost no interest. And one of the professors in the department came to me, a friendly guy, and he said to me, "You know, in your career, you can do anything you want to do, study anything you like, but don't study water." And why? He said, well, he was referring to, I guess at that time there was only one debacle that had taken place. It was a famous Russian scientist, a guy named Boris Deryagin, who got into trouble. He was probably the most famous and most recognized of all physical chemists in Russia, and there were a lot of them in Russia. And apparently, he screwed up. He didn't really screw up, but he got into trouble. He found, or someone came to his laboratory and demonstrated to him a peculiar observation regarding water, that if you put water into some cylindrical kind of container, that the water exhibited or formed some kind of dendritic structure, long, narrow structure, and this structure behaved. It was water in some sense, but it behaved differently from ordinary water. It had a higher boiling point, a lower freezing point, higher density, et cetera, et cetera. And he began touting this as maybe an interesting new characteristic form of water. And boy, was he beaten for it. Without going into great detail, because I know you have a lot to ask, basically he almost lost his career. And ultimately, he wrote an article saying that, after having been criticized, he said, "We were wrong. We screwed up." And that's the public face of what happens. There's a bit happened. There's more to it. I spoke to two people who had been really close to Boris Deryagin. One of them is an institute director in Pushino, where the same place where Deryagin had spent some time, and another was his last postdoctoral fellow. Independently, they told me the same thing, that although he recanted, he was forced to recant by the Soviet regime. They didn't want to be blamed, Soviet science was impeccable. So they shifted the blame onto Deryagin himself, and he really had no choice. If he didn't do that, he'd wind up probably in some work camp in Siberia or something like that. So he recanted. But until the day he died, both of these people independently told me he was sure that he was right. So anyway, that's one of the more famous stories about water. And it's one of the reasons why scientists don't particularly enjoy, or they have no real proclivity to enter into the arena of water. You know, it's pretty risky. If you immerse your toes into the water, you may sink.
But I mean, looking at, you know, the, I mean, just looking at our bodies, I mean, we're 2/3 water. And I know you mentioned that if we line up all the molecules, you know, that we have in the body, it's like 99.5% all water. So just looking at that, obviously, when it comes to life and comes to our function, water is fundamental. So the research is really needed in that area.
Well, it depends on your point of view. Of course, I agree with you without question. It's fundamental. But, you know, if you read a standard biochemistry book or physiology book, the water molecules don't do a whole lot. They basically form the solvent for the more important molecules of life. And so chapter one, whether it's cell biology or biochemistry, they always talk about water, and then they forget about it as though there's an obligatory mention of water, and then, yeah, you know, water doesn't do anything. It just sits there. And you know, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to think, just if you think of it from a layman's point of view, it's hard to argue that 99% of the molecules in your body don't do it, basically don't do anything. You know, it's not like Mother Nature. Everything is there for a reason and a purpose. So just from that naive point of view, it's really hard to argue that the water doesn't do anything. But of course, there's so much beyond that that is indicating that water does a lot. And in the first book that I wrote about water, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, that's a pretty cover. And that first book, half of the book, the first half argues that there is such a thing as so-called structured water that Gilbert Ling, Albert St. George, and others have been arguing for years. I tried to present that story in a way that was understandable. And the second half dealt with what does that water do? And I presented evidence, each one chapter per system, that various systems in your body, like, for example, muscle cells, nerve cells, secretory cells, et cetera, that in each case, that a transition of the water from this so-called structured variety, we now call it fourth phase or easy water, transition from the structured phase to ordinary liquid water, and then back again, is a cycle that these fundamental cells undergo. And if these fundamental cells do it, then probably other cells do it too. Of course, we couldn't consider every cell in the body, but basically some of the more important cells, the evidence, contrary to what you read in the textbook, the evidence suggests that the water is intimately involved. So, you know, when a cell springs into action, it's not just the proteins that undergo some kind of change to bring about this effect, but it's the water and the proteins together. And this kind of transition of water and proteins from one state to another is called a phase transition. And that was the essence of what was presented. So this book has been out now for more than 20 years. I think it was 2001. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that the water is absolutely centrally involved in everything the cell does. So
all the studies that you've done, you know, since then, because obviously 20 years, there's a lot that you've set up, a lot of, you know, research that you've done since then. it's still, these theories still hold water, sort of say. I mean, they still.
They hold water, right.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. They hold water. I need to adopt that into my lexicon.
Yeah. Explain a little bit for the listener. I know, obviously, you've talked a lot about this in the past, but to kind of, in a simple picture, explain what easy water is, structured water, or, you know, all the different terms that you use.
So the word structured water is the old, you might say, classical term. And the idea is that the water has structure to it. So if you think about this kind of water, which I should be drinking more than I keep getting reminded that it really is important to drink water. I should know, but you know, it goes, I'm too busy. So this kind of liquid water, the molecules are not structured, so to speak. So the individual molecules of H2O, they're bouncing around at a fierce number of times per second, or even per femtosecond, and they're randomly disposed in here. And so that has no real, quote, structure. But the argument has been in the past, Gilbert Ling especially, and Albert St. George is considered by many to be the father of modern biochemistry. He won a Nobel Prize for discovering vitamin C. And, you know, his intellect was really rich. He was revered even by other Nobel laureates as a really creative guy who came up with so much. So these two guys, and Gilbert Ling, by the way, he passed a couple of years ago, just shy of 100 years old. And he was chosen, he was in the first cohort of people who came from China. In 1948, the Chinese government chose from throughout all of China, they picked three young people to come and study in the U.S. Now the drain is kind of moving in the opposite direction, but so all of China, they picked a chemist, a physicist, and a biologist. And Gilbert Ling was the biologist. The chemist went on to win a Nobel Prize in his field. The physicist went to win a Nobel Prize in his field. And Gilbert Ling should have won at least two Nobel Prizes for all that he did, but he was not so fortunate. His work in water was controversial, because everything in water is controversial. Anyway, between the two of these guys, they talked a lot about water structure, the idea being that in biology, at least, and we know now that it's way beyond biology only, in biology, at least, the water molecules were somehow organized or lined up or structured, if you will, you know, like soldiers at attention. And that was a really controversial view. However, that's where the word structure originated. And it's not really a great term to use, because everything has structure. Even if it's random structure, it has structure. But I think, you know, people understand when one talks about structured water. Well, when we started our studies, I'll explain a little bit about the water that so-called structured water. We gave it different names. I'll talk about the characteristics of that in a moment. But because the properties were so vastly different from ordinary liquid water, we opted to call it a fourth phase of water, a different phase where the molecules were not like liquid water, as I just described, but somehow ordered, not the way Gilbert Ling suggested, we found, but the same kind of idea, that there was some kind of order. Ordered water is another, is used as well. So we called it fourth phase. We also called it exclusion zone, or easy to remember, easy exclusion zone water, because this kind of water is like a crystal. You know, when the molecules are organized or aligned with one another, that's the characteristic of a crystal, and crystals tend to exclude solutes and particles. Otherwise, they wouldn't be pure. You know, you got to get rid of what's in the original solution in order to gain purity. And so they exclude. It's sort of like at the bottom of a glacier, when ice is formed, you have a glacial moraine with all the junk that had been in the water that was freezing. So that's where the name EZE water and fourth phase water, that's how they acquired their name. So what is this EZE water? Well, you know, some years of study with a lot of talented students and postdocs and colleagues led to an understanding. So the first characteristic when we began studying it, we're looking for an experimental preparation where we could find something that's crystal-like, and we exploited the characteristic of crystals that they tend to exclude. So we took a chamber and we put in particles, little spheres called microspheres, and we plunked into the chamber a gel, a hydrogel, that is a gel that contained water. It was a polyvinyl gel that we started with. And we looked in the microscope, and what we saw next to the surface of the gel is that these microspheres, these particles, began to get excluded, and they got pushed away from the surface of the gel, creating a zone that had no particles. So we have a gel, and next to the gel is this zone with no particles, and all the particles are shoved out here. So that's how it got the name exclusion zone. But of course, we studied many characteristics of the water that was in this zone, and everything we studied looked different from ordinary water, and that's how we derived the name the fourth phase of water. So let me just tell you just a couple of characteristics of it that are really important. The first was that it's not neutral. So water, H2O, is neutral, but this zone we found is typically negatively charged. And to find out that it was negatively charged, we basically made direct measurements, sticking electrodes into that zone. And we found negative charge in that zone. So from that, we surmised, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out if this stuff is negative, it can't be H2O because H2O is neutral. So it had to undergo some change. And we found that the actual structure is H3O2. And we found also through a whole bunch of different studies that what happened is that the water molecules, you know, all of this starts with water molecules, with liquid water. You pour the liquid water in the chamber next to the gel or next to the some kind of hydrophilic water-loving surface, and a transformation begins. And it begins with the first molecular layer of water. So it interfaces with that solid or gel, and the gel creates a kind of template, the gel surface, that propels the transition of the water molecules into a sheet-like structure that's a honeycomb. It has a hexagonal motif. So if you were to look this way, you would see hexagons. And, you know, it's very common throughout nature. And that first sheet then serves as the template for the growth of the second sheet from the water molecules, and so on and so forth. So this grows sheet by sheet. And it can grow, you know, many sheets, easily hundreds of thousands, and maybe close to, under the right circumstances, a million or millions of these sheets. And when you translate that into a dimension that we know, you know, half a millimeter is not atypical. And we've seen sometimes a full meter or more in the right kind of chamber. So this can grow hugely. And so that's the second characteristic. Third characteristic is, you know, I mentioned that typically it has negative charge. If anybody is thinking while I'm talking, they would think, well, wait a second, something's wrong here, because you start with water. Water is neutral. If you've got a zone with negative charge, what happened to the positive charges? we found that they're pushed out as the exclusion zone forms, and they're pushed out into the water beyond. So you've got negative, and then you have positive, and they remain separated from one another. That's a battery. And we found that if you stick electrodes, one in the negative, one in the positive, you can light an LED, for example. You get current out of that. So you can get electricity out of that. The electricity in theory could be when properly engineered, it could yield appreciable amount of current and could serve as a new, you might say, revolutionary source of electrical energy. And also for the cell, because this stuff exists inside your cells. Your cells are full of hydrophilic surfaces, the proteins, the nucleic acids, and this stuff builds next to those and essentially fills your cell. Every cell in your body, if it's healthy, it should be filled with EZ or fourth phase water, you see. So the energetic implications are important. But just one last thing before I rag on and on. Every battery needs charging. So you have a smartphone, right? I think you do. And I'm the only one.
I try to be as smart as my phone, but it's not working.
It doesn't work for any of us. No. Well, some of us don't own cell phones.
Good for you.
I'm on the threshold of relenting because it's just impossible. So I just went to see an optometrist. It's been years, and they instructed me, don't come into our office, sit in your car, tell us you're here, and then we'll text you when we're ready for you to come in. But if you have no phone, you can't be texted. So this is just one of so many examples now of how it's becoming impossible to live without a cell phone. Anyway, that's beside the point. But the point I'm making is that your cell phone and all others need to be plugged in. You go to sleep, you plug it in, you wake up in the morning, it's refreshed. It's got new energy. All batteries need recharging. And so what I'm talking about with the water is essentially a battery. You've got plus and minus, just like the battery inside your cell phone. And it needs to be charged. It can't just keep producing electrical energy without some input energy of some sort. Nature can convert one kind of energy to another, but it can't create energy, right? So it's got to come from somewhere. And we couldn't figure it out. And, I spent a lot of time scratching my head. That's why the hair is kind of missing, trying to figure out where does the energy come from. You can't take the chamber and attach a plug and plug it into a receptacle and think, that's not working, not feasible. So where does it come from? And we couldn't figure out. And finally, it was a student who figured out. This student was doing, he didn't know he was figuring it out. He was doing something that he was not supposed to do. So he's got one of these chambers that I just described.
That's usually how inventions come to place is when you do something you shouldn't and you see the effect of it.
Well, Michael, you're right. And I'm not telling the story exactly as it was. I encourage the students to do that, do something you're not supposed to do. And it's been remarkable how the students come up with observations that we never would have thought of. It's just by serendipity. So the student took, it was a lamp, a gooseneck lamp that was sitting next to the chamber. He took the lamp and he shined it on the chamber. And he saw that the region of the chamber that had been illuminated, that the exclusion zone just grew and grew and grew. And he ran to my office, called me in, take a look at this. So I took a look and I was astonished because, it seemed pretty obvious. The region that received light was growing. The EZ was growing. Fourth phase was growing. So, it seemed pretty clear that light, photons, some kind of optical energy was responsible for building the EZ. Yeah. And then we checked different wavelengths in genuine bona fide experiments, and we found that most wavelengths didn't do anything. We tried UV, we went through the visible spectrum, and when we got to the infrared, the long wavelengths, then it was like gangbusters. Just a small amount of infrared energy built the exclusion zone like crazy. We could, with an LED, a weak LED generating infrared light at a wavelength of about 3 micrometers, we could expand the EZ by 10 times.
Incredible.
It was incredible, indeed, incredible. So that's the,
So how did you ever try then to have it in completely black, you know, where there was no light coming in, and then seeing how the easy, how that zone behaved?
We have, but you know, you need to realize that that infrared is a wavelength that we can't see. So if you were to turn off all the lights in your studio or room or wherever you are, and you can't see anything, and if you whip out your smartphone and try to get a photo, you won't, even with a sensitive detector, you won't get anything. If you took your phone and replaced the sensor with an infrared sensor, you'd get a beautiful image of everything despite the darkness. So it's always there. And even if you go into a deep cave that is dark and black, and you still have plenty of infrared energy. You can get beautiful images of everything around you with an infrared camera, because everything is generating infrared energy. It comes, you know, ultimately comes from the sun, whose energy is roughly half is in the infrared region. That's why you feel warmth. So we generally equate warmth with infrared. The two are not exactly the same, but you know, close enough. We've done that.
It seems to me that, you know, because as a human being, we all talk about mitochondrial health, you know, about the energy production, and the cells need energy in order to be able to repair and to live healthily, to detoxify, and all these different things. So it seems to me, if we can maximize the amount of easy water within the cells, that we can then also maximize the youthfulness of the cell.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, this is, you should be working in our laboratory. this is precisely the point. So your cells, when they're healthy, they should be full of easy water. And by the way, parenthetically, easy water is negative. Your cell is negative. And I've argued before that the reason why our cells have potential differences of -50 to 100 millivolts is because of the water, because the EZ water is negatively charged, that it has nothing to do with the pumps and channels in the membrane. And this is the commonly held view. And it explains why if you have a gel, you know, no membrane, no pumps, no channels, nothing like that, and you stick the same electrode that you stuck into the cell, stick it in the gel, you get the same result. But there's no membrane gadgetry, but you got the same result. So I think the reason for the negative electrical potential inside the cell is the water that has negative charge. You know, you have a container, you fill it with negatively charged stuff, and of course you measure negative electrical potential. It's as simple as that. And the corollary of that is that from what you said, you know, is that sick cells don't have a full complement of easy water. And if you look in the literature from 60 or 70 years ago, where many people were making electrical measurements inside the cell, including ourselves, if you look at cancer cells, for example, cancer cells, instead of -60, -70, -80 millivolt, it's -10 or -15 millivolt, implying, if our argument is correct, there's not much easy water inside the cell. And so for me, this is a really important clue that in terms of cancer, that, you know, the cell Well, you know, cancer cells tend to be rather undifferentiated. And so the solid surfaces that are required for building easy water are not in huge quantity. And this could be a fundamental clue as to the genesis of cancer. And the same with, for example, pathological kidney cells. If you look at the literature, same thing, 10, 15 millivolts negative instead of 60 or 70. Not enough easy water. So the corollary that is, if you want to keep the cell healthy, you got to make sure that there's enough easy water. And there are many expedients that can be used to build easy water. You know, common expedients, the most common of which is to do this.
Drink some.
Yeah, so you know, you drink the water, and some of that water, not all, some gets peed out, but some of it gets converted into easy water. A fraction of it gets converted, and that's one way of, basically you're rehydrating the cell, and that's why, you know, everybody says drink more water, drink more water, drink more water. I wish I could learn that.
It's too much to do.
Exactly right. It's too much to do. But
So the key, I mean, it seems very fundamental to me. So you need to hydrate. I mean, I know, what was that book? You know, the cure for all the water, the cure for all disease, or there was a gentleman.
Bat Mangalesh, the Iranian one.
Exactly. Where he was treating prisoners just with water alone. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. He could cure all kinds of diseases by drinking more water.
Yeah, that's incredible. So it seems very fundamental to me to just drink plenty of water and then be out in sunshine. I mean, that seems to be a very kind of a strong driver for health and mitochondrial activity.
Absolutely. Being out in the sunshine. So where I live here in Seattle, in the wintertime, we don't get much sunshine. We get clouds up there. You know, a lot of people get depressed because of that. Many people leave for places farther south where there's more sunshine, and then they return. The summers are really glorious here, but the winter can be, you know, pretty depressing for a lot of people. So yeah, the sun is important. And if you don't have the sun, you know, basically the argument would be that the sun is providing infrared energy, and we need the infrared energy to grow easy, to build easy from whatever water we drink. Some of it comes from inside because we have heat that's generated, metabolic heat, which is essentially generating infrared energy. So we have infrared coming from inside, from the core of our body, and from outside, both. So now if you don't get enough of that, then you're not building easy water sufficiently, but there is a solution, and the Finns discovered it, and the Russians a long time ago, called, we call it sauna, they call it sauna. The Russians call it banya. You know, what is it? It's heat, whether it's moist heat or dry heat, it may matter, but it's not the critical factor. The critical factor is the heat. So you're getting infrared energy, as I said, not exactly the same as heat, but close enough. And that energy builds easy water. And so, you know, you immerse yourself into the sauna. You come out 20 minutes later and you're feeling like $1 million. Your headache is gone. Your depression is gone. Your et cetera, et cetera. And why is that? Well, so I would argue that the reason is very simple. It's the infrared energy is building easy water. So there are some other expedients besides that. So for example, some substances that are known, or, you know, have been known for thousands of years, since ancient China or even Ayurvedic times, to be good for health. And of course, lots of people have speculated on why these substances are so good for health, like curcumin and turmeric, for example. That's just classic example. You know, no matter what ails you, it's suggested that you take some of this stuff and you'll feel better. And seems to have worked over the years, although modern medicine has largely forgotten about it, but there's a resurgence and revival. So we wondered some years ago, so there seem to be two possibilities. One is that we have receptors all over our body for turmeric. Somehow it's built into us. That's one hypothesis. And the second one is that, simpler one, is that turmeric has an effect of creating easy water, you know, and since the water is all over your body, that could impact every conceivable region of your body, right? And so we tested it. We tested not only turmeric, but holy basil and you know, a half dozen other substances, including ghee, for example. And all of them, we found in experiments, had the capacity for building easy water over a wide concentration range, a range that would be relevant for your body. So we concluded from that, that one way of building easy water, and thereby building health, is to take some of these substances. You know, 5,000 years ago, they knew that. We know it now, but I think we've provided a reason for it.
So, and another substance that I know you studied is propolis, you know, that, and that's the same thing with that substance as well.
Same thing with propolis. The bees use it to build their hives, and we use it too. And we can use it too. And that also builds easy water. So there's just one more. I don't want to fail to mention it, and that is earthing or grounding, right? And there have been lots of studies on this, and you know, lots of people ground themselves, and they take off their shoes and walk on the beach right near the water, and you know, most of us who've done that, we feel good afterward. Or we take off our shoes and socks and walk on the grass, especially wet grass, and we feel good. So what's going on? Multiple theories exist, and lots of people, there are lots of biophysical studies, and you know, it's clear that grounding or earthing ourselves create health. But why? Okay, so simple, again, I'm a believer in simplicity. If it's too complicated, I don't understand it. And if I don't understand it, you know, I used to think that the reason I don't understand it is because I'm stupid, and that still applies. However, you know, sometimes the mechanisms that you read about in the textbook, they're so complicated that they're simply not understandable. And, you know, I now realize that in some cases, at least, it's simply because they're wrong. And you can never, if something is wrong, you can never make it simple. It's always complicated. And anything that builds on it is equally complicated. So I've kind of changed my tune. Okay, so what about when you ground yourself? What happens when you do that? Well, so I used to think that the earth was neutral, no net charge. And I started my career in electrical engineering. And no professor ever told me that the earth, that if we plug in, you know, an electrical plug into the socket, this third round prong, nobody told me that it connected to anything other than a bland neutrality. Never did I hear a word. And so I was surprised about 15 years ago when a Russian guy in my laboratory began telling me, began talking about the Earth's electric field. I said, Andre, what are you talking about? You mean the Earth's magnetic field? I never heard of electric field. He said, he was shocked, so to speak. You never heard of the electric field? Don't you know that the ionosphere is positively charged and the Earth is negatively charged? It forms a kind of capacitor with an electric field in between. I never heard such a thing. He said
that was Tesla. He did a lot of, you know, studies with that, you know, to draw the energy because of that separation of charges, right?
Well, I'm no expert in that, but yeah, I've heard the same. So Tesla knew about all this stuff. Lots of people knew. 100 years ago, this was well known. But somehow the American education system has failed us. So the Russian guy Andrei in the laboratory was telling me that in Russia, every middle school student knows that the Earth is negatively charged. You know, and here, you know, someone who got a degree in electrical engineering never heard of such a thing. So I went home that evening with my head spinning. And next day, one of my students brought in the lectures of Richard Feynman, you know, the great Nobel laureate, a 3-volume set that almost every physics graduate student in the US reads. And there it was, Volume 2, Chapter 9. An entire chapter dealing with the electrical charge of the Earth and the evidence for it. So there's plenty of evidence for it. It's just that, you know, we're not educated in it because somehow our educational system, people who were involved with it, think it's somehow not so important or superfluous or whatever. But it's absolutely critical. So, you know, with that fact, we don't know it. Many people don't know it, but it's a fact. If the Earth is negatively charged and you connect yourself to the Earth, some of that electrical charge will seep into your body, especially if some region of your body is not so well electrically charged. You know, it's going to seep into our body. The current electrons tend to flow. And so we found separately in laboratory observations that if we stick some wires into water and pass current, the wire that's passing the negative charge, right around it grows an EZ region. It converts by putting electrical charge. The electrical charge, the electrons convert EZ water, which is neutral, to ordinary liquid water, which is neutral, to EZ water, which is negatively charged. It's very simple. So you walk barefoot near on the sand near the water or on wet grass, and the negative charge that enters into your body that seeps in is going to build EZ water. And so the reason you feel better, I would argue, could well have to do with the fact that your cells are building EZ water. And any regions, any particular cells that for some reason are deficient in EZ water, they'll get filled up with EZ water. So anyway,
that is another way then to recharge, you know, your battery, just like the sunlight. Now you can then recharge your battery by restoring the EZ water within your body just by walking barefoot.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to say it, recharge, because really that's what it does. It charges.
Yeah, and
it recharges. Yeah, sure.
And so I like to get back a little bit into the cell. I mean, we have like the mitochondrial activity. We talk about the electron transport, you know, chain or chain transport, and that is how then energy is produced. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you agree with our look at mitochondria and that is where energy produced? It sounds to me that it's more all these kind of easy exclusion zones with separation of charges that then start to then generate energy within the cell.
Well, okay. So if you look at the mitochondria, look at the structure of the mitochondrion, it's got internal membranes. And these internal membranes are just right for building EZ water. So I would surmise that inside the mitochondria is a buildup of EZ water, which contains negative charge. The cell needs negative charge, and this could be a source of negative charge. Now, so this is one point. Second point, which may be even more relevant, is that there actually was something of a controversy about the role of the high energy phosphate bond. And this is not something that originated with me. It actually, when the high energy bond phosphate bond was first revealed, how many years ago? 70, 80 years ago or something like that, by some physical chemists. Everybody was excited because, you know, finally we could understand about the energetics of the cell. Cool, exciting, interesting, amazing. 1 year later, and this is all pointed out by Gilbert Ling, and if you look on his website, which I think still exists, gilbertling.org, he discusses the issue. And so 1 year later, another equally distinguished physical chemical group said, no, you guys, last year, what you published is wrong. You made a simple arithmetic error, and there is no such thing as a high energy phosphate bond. Now, according to Gilbert Ling, nobody has ever followed up. So we don't know whether these guys were wrong, or perhaps the group that challenged them, maybe they were wrong. Nobody knows. It seems to me absolutely urgent that this be followed up, because, you know, if it turns out that the high energy bond really doesn't exist, you know, then the question arises, well, you know, if the energy for running our machine, our body, doesn't come from the high energy bond, where does it come from? And there, you know, we can look at the electrical energy that I was talking about from easy water. So inside the cell, for example, you've got lots of negative charges. Those negative charges want nothing more than to get away from each other because they repel one another. You know, and so the fact that they're squeezed together inside the cell means that the cell has got potential energy, and that energy could be used. And we showed in various studies, if you ask me, I can tell you more, that this energy is used. And so the more general question arises, where do we get our energy? Do we get our energy completely from ATP, from the high energy bond, which is what essentially everybody thinks right now? Or do we have some of our energy from this electrical energy that is there, this potential energy, and, you know, might as well use it if it's there? And even possibly, if the ATP idea turns out to be wrong, I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm saying it needs to be checked. It could be that we get all of our energy from electricity, basically from charge. That's what runs it. And, you know, that if it turns out that that's correct, it can kind of better explain the people who somehow survive pretty well without eating, the so-called breatharians. And there are quite a few of those. And I personally know some of them who go for, you know, long periods of time eating nothing. I, for example, a dancer. Dancer contacted me a few years back. She said, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like eating. She said, I stop eating for a month at a time and I keep dancing, you know, and dancing is not the amount of energy that's required for dancing is appreciable. And she'll go on for a month and then she'll decide, okay, I feel like eating, so I'll start eating again, et cetera, et cetera. And there are quite a few such people. So where do they get their energy, you know? And a possibility is they get their energy from the environment, from the infrared energy that then builds charge and provides energy. This is a real possibility. So I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying it's possible. And I think all of this really needs follow-up, because what could be more important for us than, you know, where do we get our energy?
I mean, these are the fundamentals in life. And I know also you've kind of taken a crack at like the origin of life, you know, in regards to, you know, how cells come together. If they're like you're talking about that, they're, you know, both of them are negatively charged. So how do they come together? You know,
if you're asking me to respond to that,
yes, please.
I will. Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of amusing, this whole thing, because, you know, if you ask anybody out on the street, what happens when you got two charges that are the same, like two negative charges, do they repel each other or do they attract each other? And probably 100% of the people will say, well, they repel each other, right? And but it turns out that if you put them in water, more often they attract each other instead of repelling each other. And that's been demonstrated for many years. And we demonstrated ourselves with at least one paper that we produce, you know, just putting, you put two negatively charged spheres in the water. And what happens, you expect them, you know, the reflexive response is they're going to do this, come up, but actually they do this, they come together. And so there are, you know, lots of observations of this that are not taken seriously, but they were taken seriously by one Richard Feynman, the same guy I was talking about, the Nobel physicist who, you know, many will label not only the funniest guy in the second half of the 20th century, but the Einstein of the second half of the 20th century. So, a sense of humor and a brilliant guy. And so he talked about this, and I think it was his Nobel lecture where he talked about it. And he called it the phenomenon like likes like. So like charged, they like each other, so they come together, right? And he said like likes like because of an intermediate of unlike. So he said somehow, he didn't know exactly how, you got these two negatively charged blobs. And if you have positive charge in the middle, the positive charge will attract these negative charges and they'll come together. And they'll come together just to the point where the attractive force that's bringing them together is balanced by the repulsive force between these. Then they're stable at some sort. So like likes like because of an intermediate of unlike. See, so where does the unlike, where does all this come from? And we studied this and we published it. So if you have like a sphere that's negatively charged and you put it in water, it's going to develop an EZ. And the EZ has negative charge. And as the negatively charged EZ builds around this one and around this one, it casts off protons because that's what happens when this build, and that's the way you get a balance. You know, you start with neutral water and you get negative here and positive beyond. So in between these two spheres will be the highest concentration of positive charges because the positive charges are coming from this sphere and this sphere. So they're highest here. So they'll draw together. And we produced evidence that this is indeed so. What was the original question?
We were talking about the origin of life
and
how cells come together.
Right. Okay. So, or how molecules,
cells to, you have sperm, you have egg, you have, I mean, all these different things, you have tissue regeneration, you know, how do cells structure and kind of place themselves, you know, where they're at and the structure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you can imagine on the primitive Earth, before any life began, you've got substances and they're spread all over the Earth. There's no reason to think that they would be at the beginning, that they would be concentrated, but in order to form a cell, they need to be concentrated. You know, you need something to come together in a blob. Mm-hmm. There was plenty of infrared energy to build easy water. And there was supposedly an aqueous environment. And so there we are. We have all of the necessary components or ingredients to bring things together. I mean, this is not the full story of the origin of life. Not too many people were present to witness it. So, you know, we don't know. But at least I think this is an important starting point.
So when we're talking, I mean, this summit is about regenerative medicine. So in order to be able to regenerate, I mean, it seems to me that by building this, the higher amount of easy water, it will then create more of a likes like, sort of say, you know, which will then build stronger tissue, regenerate joints, regenerate muscles, you know, when you have more of that. That kind of concentration of separation of charges.
Absolutely. Yeah, right on. Nothing more to say. You're right. I'm with you. That's true.
And another thing that I wanted to kind of get into is, you know, we're talking about, you know, things like high blood pressure, talking about how does, you know, blood flow through blood vessels, you know, how does things move, you know, in within tubules or within tubes, you know, is it just the heart that's pumping it? Is that the only thing, or does easy water play a role in that? And then by maximizing the amount of easy water, will that help then in regards to blood pressure and so forth?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So you've read and educated yourself in the material. So yeah, let me discuss this. The bottom line is that our conclusion is that it's not just the heart that drives the blood flow. It's also the vessels themselves. We got two sources, the heart and the vessels. So it starts with an observation of another undergraduate student who was doing what he wasn't supposed to do. We had just discovered that one of the materials that we had been using pretty often for many of our studies, a polymer called Nafion, we were using it in sheets, and we found out it comes in tubes. So I asked the student, this young, eager undergraduate student, to take a look at the tubes. And even though they had a cylindrical kind of geometry, please, could you check to see if they form EZs? And we knew that EZs formed next to planar surfaces, but we didn't know about curved surfaces at the time. So he went into the lab, and you know, before I knew it, he had confirmed that, yeah, it was both outside and inside the tube. If you immerse the tube in water, you get EZs. And I was busy doing something or other. I didn't have time to discuss with him what he should do next. So he was full of initiative, and he did some more. And a week or two later, I'm sitting in my office with a visitor. And as I recall, it was a kind of important guy, but the discussion was sort of dull. There was not much happening during the discussion. And so I was eager to be interrupted. And the student comes barging in. Usually the students are a bit more polite. You know, I leave my door ajar, and they'll kind of peek their head in and say, "Are you busy?" or something like this. But this guy pushed open the door, and without even a hesitation, he said, "I found something interesting. I thought you'd like to know." "Okay, you know, tell me what you found that's so interesting." You know, with some degree of skepticism, some feigned annoyance at he had the temerity to barge in while I'm speaking to this important visitor. And he says, "You know, I'm looking, and what I see is that I immerse these tubes into water, and I observe what's going on, and the water flows through the tubes like flowing through a straw." He said, "And the tube is immersed in the water," and he said, "it keeps going, it doesn't stop." And I'm thinking, if he's right, this is really important, because, you know, usually you need a pressure to drive fluid through a tube, right? And, you know, like in the cardiovascular system, the heart develops pressure to drive the blood through the large arteries and into the smaller vessels. So I'm thinking, there's no pressure difference here because it's just a tube that's immersed in the water. That's all. And yet the flow is going through the tube. So I'm thinking, if he's right, and we quickly confirmed that he was right, this is pretty important. It probably indicates somehow that the infrared energy that's being absorbed by the water is somehow getting converted, getting used, easy buildup, which is then converted into some kind of mechanical energy. So we were really, really eager. And, you know, in retrospect, I was thrilled that the student actually came in to bother me, to disturb me. The students, you know, without those students, they're amazing. Really open-minded at the young age. So I then proposed an idea to a different student of mine. And he reiterates that he thought I was on some kind of drug when I proposed this experiment. until he got a positive result, then he changed his mind. I suggested to him that, you know, he might want to have a look at the cardiovascular system, because there are lots of tubes, you know, and maybe there's propulsion in those tubes. I would never have thought so, because, you know, I began my career studying the cardiovascular system, the pressures and flows, doing modeling of the cardiovascular system. And I thought we had it all worked out. You know, we knew all the answers, I thought. I had a pretty arrogant sense until I went to Russia and my friend Vladimir Vyakov introduced me to his neighbor. And in 5 minutes, the guy had me convinced that there was something that was terribly wrong with our understanding of the cardiovascular system. It was very simple. He said, you know, your capillaries and mine, or especially in young people, they can be down to 3 or 4 micrometers in diameter. But the red cells that need to pass through those capillaries are twice the diameter. They're 6 or 7 micrometers. You know, it's sort of like a plumbing problem. You know, your toilet gets stuffed, and, you know, in order, you got to take the plunger and you push and exert a fair amount of energy to kind of squeeze it all through and clear the line. Well, same thing's got to happen in the cardiovascular system. And if you look at the videos of the red cells passing through those capillaries, you can see that, you know, ordinarily they look like a plate or a donut. And as they're going through, they're actually squeezed like this. And so he calculated how much energy, I don't know if he used the plumber analogy or not, but so he computed that the amount of energy required to squeeze these red blood cells and push them through is something like 1 million times the pressure developed by the left ventricle. So, you know, you mentioned earlier something about high blood pressure. This is high blood pressure. And even, you know, if the guy's, it's easy for calculations to be off. Even if this guy's calculations were off by a couple of orders of magnitude, instead of 6 orders of magnitude, a million times, where it could be 4 orders of, it's still an immense problem. So where does his energy come from? And he'd been thinking about the problem and he had a few suggestions. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, we just completed these experiments, immersing the tube in water and you get flow through the tube. And the energy is coming from infrared, from outside. So, you know, once again, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out maybe the same phenomenon that we saw in the laboratory inside those Nafion tubes is occurring in our blood vessels, which have hydrophilic surfaces. So I then proposed it to my student who told me he thought I was in some kind of drug, but, you know, he listened to me and he politely went ahead and he got a positive result. And what we did was we tested on the chick embryo, looking at the cardiovascular system. So the first thing is what he did, I say we, but he did it. He stopped the heart by injecting potassium chloride. So the ventricle wasn't pumping anymore. So we'd all expect that the flow would stop. It didn't stop, it kept going at much lower velocity, but it kept going. So if it keeps going, you know, there's got to be something that's driving it. And driving it now against the obstacle of a heart that's just in the way, it's not beating, it's just sitting there, you know, you try to pump and it's this kind of blockade, but still there's some flow that keeps going. And by the way, I should say that this has been reported over the past century some half dozen times in different preparations. People noticed, but nobody paid attention, that flow kept going even when the heart stopped beating, you know. So
it's almost like the beating of the heart serves a different function, or maybe it's kind of a small function in regards to kind of moving the blood, but maybe there's some other function that relates to the creation of easy water within. I mean, there may be some other function of the beating of the heart other than just creating pressure.
Well, yeah, that's right. And my student likes to think, Zheng Li is his name, it gives a kind of momentum to the blood to make sure that in this vessel propulsion mechanism that is going in the right way toward the periphery rather than back to the heart.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. This is his idea. It's an interesting concept. But at any rate, you know, we don't know at this stage. What we tested is whether the signature feature of this mechanism that we found in the laboratory also exists in the cardiovascular system. Namely, you give infrared energy, and it drives it faster. That's what we found in the laboratory. We found it also in the cardiovascular system. So it looks as though this mechanism really is operative, which means in turn that our cardiovascular system runs. We have two drivers, and one is the heart and one is the vessels themselves. And we don't know what fraction, you know, if you don't have this obstacle heart that's in the way, we don't know how much of the energy is actually comes from the vessels versus from the heart. It could be that the heart is driving 99% of it and 1% comes from the vessels, or it could be the opposite way. We simply don't know, and we need to do experiments in the future to try to find out what's going on. So, you know, it's a kind of new concept in our cardiovascular system. And, you know, like with any new concept, if it's correct, and then new therapeutic modalities will inevitably arise. Some of them are ones that we could never even have imagined. You know, it's only after the discovery comes that you find applications that you'd never have dreamed of. So this is pretty exciting, you know, and
yeah, it's exciting. I mean, it's a really exciting time too, when science shifts, or you're part of that process of shifting the way we look at things, and then seeing the implications and how that can be utilized, and then develop therapeutics, you know, based on the new way of seeing things. So I mean, that's a really exciting time.
It's incredibly exciting. And on the other hand, you know, the flip side that you're probably well aware of is that many scientists don't like new findings. You know, you know the system. But, you know, you learn something and you feel you've got a body of knowledge. And when someone challenges some aspect of that body of knowledge, well, Michael, you know, there's a lot of resistance that comes. And we've receive some resistance. I got to tell you that the excitement that side is greatly exceeds the resistance. So many people have taken up these ideas and begun to run with them, but it poses an obstacle when you try to get funding for your laboratory. So you understand that very well. We were really fortunate to have a private funder who absolutely generously was funding our laboratory for the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, I think. And he suddenly ran into financial obstacles. So what had been a smooth ride from a private funder, getting money from, you know, the national organizations is a real problem, because the people who are making judgment are the people you're challenging. It doesn't usually work to your advantage that way. So we had this funding and suddenly we lost it. So we're now in a position of a real jeopardy in keeping our laboratory going. And you know, anybody who's paying attention, who's done well and is as excited as we are by these findings, please do contact me. We would really appreciate your support.
Well, I mean, and the implications and why it's important that your work continues. I mean, you're talking about cancer. We're talking about mitochondrial activity. You know, all the diseases that relates obviously with premature degeneration, all the inflammatory conditions. You know, cardiovascular. I mean, it's just layer upon layer of implications that can then benefit from the type of research that you're doing.
Well, thank you. I feel precisely the same way. And we don't even know some of the implications because, you know, sometimes you trip over some finding, which leads to other findings and so on, and you go in directions that you can't predict. And it's just, you know, having the, you might say, confidence that we're going in productive direction with a fundamental understanding can yield all kinds of amazing dividends that are not even predictable. It kind of reminds me, I just got to mention, you know, we know the name Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, and perhaps you know the story. Lord Kelvin, famous chemist, I guess, physical chemist, you know, and he was famous for a grand pronouncement. He said, and I quote, or it's kind of a quote, "Nothing heavier than air will ever fly." A few years later came the Wright brothers. Exactly. So, exactly. You know, it's easy to come up with pronouncements, but those pronouncements don't always hold water, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And science is there to always be proven wrong.
Well, yeah, it's so true. But, you know, we're also humans. And as humans, we become familiar with a certain way of thinking. And we often don't like to be challenged.
No, exactly.
It's human nature.
Well, Professor Polak, it is such a pleasure, such an honor, and what you bring to the world is revolutionary. So thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate that. It's been my pleasure.